This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, as you know, we mostly talk about health policy and reform on this show, but it is flu season, and I'm going to join the chorus of voices of health officials in strongly urging everyone to get out there and get their flu vaccine. I know I took my four children the other day. There weren't too many screams, but we all got our shots and got in and out pretty quickly. And there are plenty of flu shots to go around this year and plenty of places you can go. Your local community health center, your primary care provider, even the chain stores like CVS and Walgreens have their doors open. In fact, if you go to flu.gov, the flu vaccine finder widget allows you to simply enter your zip code and locate a flu clinic nearby.
Well, Mark, if it seems like we're making a public service announcement, I guess we are, so we'll take it all the way through. And as I say to our staff, don't be selfish. It's not just about protecting you from flu. It's about protecting people from catching the flu from you. If everyone's vaccinated, we're all better off. But Mark, what a difference a year makes. If you remember the H1N1 or swine flu panic last year and the lines outside the doors, very different.
Certainly it was a different story from last year at this time with the shortage and panic. It's also different flu season because you only need to get one vaccine this year to protect you from both the seasonal vaccine and the H1N1. Last year, people needed to get two vaccines, one for the 2009 H1N1 and one for the seasonal vaccine.
And there are other things to worry about this year, and a shot won't help them. The economy seems to be slowly and painfully recovering, but not fast enough to help so many unemployed. And the New York Times yesterday had a front page story telling us what the plans were to undo health reform bill by some people in the country. So while we aren't panicked about swine flu or H1N1 this year, still lots to be concerned about as the holidays approach.
So let's get back to the policy conversations. And we turn to today's guest. We're very excited that Senator Tom Daschle is here with us today. He's written a new book called Getting It Done, How Obama in Congress Finally Broke the Stalemate to make way for healthcare reform. Senator Daschle has his firsthand experience with health reform, and he understands the intricacies of legislation. You may even recall his first book about healthcare before the passage of healthcare reform called Critical. We're happy Senator Daschle can join us today.
And no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Subscribe to iTunes and get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. Think about becoming a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and follow us on Twitter.
I'm a fan, and as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Senator Daschle, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. The government has a new plan in hopes of finally ending the smoking epidemic. The Department of Health unveiled a comprehensive tobacco control strategy. It wants warning labels on packs of cigarettes to be replaced with gruesome images, covering half the front and back of packs and 20% of large ads that could include emaciated cancer patients or diseased organs. Howard Koh, Assistant Secretary for Health and chair of the working group that developed the department's action plan titled Ending the Tobacco Epidemic, said these evidence-based actions are part of a broader strategy that will create a society free of tobacco-related death and disease.
While our country has made great progress in reducing tobacco dependence, this devastating challenge remains far from solved. Tobacco use remains the leading cause of premature and preventable death in our society. In the United States, smoking causes almost 500,000 deaths a year, over 1,000 people a day.
The FDA will gather public comment on 36 proposed images now through January 9th, and 9 will be selected by June 22nd after reviewing the scientific literature, the public comments, and a study involving 1,800 people. Beginning in October 2012, cigarette makers that do not put the new warnings on their packaging will not be allowed to sell their brands in the United States. Doctors are rebelling against a 23% cut in Medicare fees that go into effect December 1st, unless the lame duck Congress staves it off. The scheduled cuts are the consequence of a 1990s budget balancing law whose requirements Congress has routinely postponed. Republicans and Democrats in Congress are still unable to come together on an agreement. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius said the administration is committed to working with providers to avert the scheduled cuts. However, she did not specify in her remarks where Congress should look for funds to pay for either the 13th-month fix or a long-term remedy. A reprieve of a few months may be the likeliest outcome.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Tom Daschle, former United States Senator and Senate Majority Leader and author of Getting It Done, How Obama and Congress Finally Broke the Stalemate to Make Way for Healthcare Reform. Welcome, Senator Daschle.
Thank you very much, Mark.
In the opening of your book, you posed the question, why did we undertake such a massive bill despite the economic situation that the country faced? And you framed your answer around 3 points. First, the problems with our healthcare system are so serious that we had to address them in order to have a full economic recovery. Second, the law was written to pay for itself. And finally, if it didn't happen now, it would be another generation before we could try it again. With the November elections behind us, it would seem that the country might not have grasped the importance of those three drivers. What was the disconnect?
Well, I think the disconnect in part was a lack of appreciation of what the bill and the law now may do for so many Americans in terms of access and cost and quality. We have a very slow ramp up to full implementation. And the downside to that is that people aren't going to see results initially. And I think people are in America are somewhat impatient and want to be able to see things before they can come to any conclusion. The other thing I would say is that we were outspent. Those of us who advocate for the law were probably outspent 7 or 8 to 1. Dramatic imbalance in terms of the tremendous campaign with regard to the characterization of this new law versus the other side, those of us who supported it, with limited resources and very little ability to counter.
Senator, you summarized the many goals of a 2,000-plus page bill in very simple language, really: address rising costs, uneven quality, and gaps in access. And 6 months, or more than 6 months now, after the passage of the act, the initial implementation phase has taken place. I think perhaps more than many Americans appreciate, the government has set up that consumer website, healthcare.gov. It's established the temporary high-risk pools for people with pre-existing conditions, established new rules for minimum benefits for new plans, including prevention, and funded most of the states to begin working on the health insurance exchanges. And at the community level, we see really unprecedented support for community health centers, school health centers, public health. So that is a lot of progress. But is the administration effectively tying these successes and these advances to those very clear goals that I don't think most Americans would disagree with, addressing rising costs, uneven quality, and the access gaps?
Well, I think that's right, Margaret. My feeling is, and has been for some time, that we haven't done a very good job of messaging, that is, explaining what it is this law is designed to do and how well it's already done it. I give the Department of Health and Human Services high marks for implementation so far. They've made most of the deadlines. They've done it without any major screw-ups. And as you say, it's already expanded the scope of our opportunities to serve in addressing all three of those challenges. Now, I wish we could go faster. I wish there was more we could do in a more visible and comprehensive way. But the law prescribes this slow implementation in large measure for one reason. We want to get it right.
Senator, given the magnitude of what health reform represents, it's not surprising that reading your book, Getting It Done, How Obama and Congress Finally Broke the Stalemate to Make Way for Healthcare Reform, is it's sometimes like reading a Tom Clancy novel. Victory seems to be within reach, then the unforeseeable and unthinkable happens. Republican Scott Brown wins the late Senator Kennedy's seat, and the 60th Senate vote disappears. There are epic blizzards, negotiated deals that blow up, the emergence of formerly obscure rules for proceedings like reconciliation, and the face-off between government leaders. As always, it's largely a story of people and their ability to lead others. As we move forward, who are the individuals you see as ensuring the success of health reform, and who are the ones most likely to achieve what Ted Kennedy called keeping the dream alive?
Well, that's a great question, Mark, and I think it starts with the president. The president has to continue to make health care and this law a high priority in his administration. There are some who are concerned that given the tremendous competition for the president's time and attention, that it's hard to do that, hard to keep coming back to health care now that the legislation has passed. But that's exactly what has to happen. He has to continue to be the messenger in chief and the implementer in chief, and that will determine a good deal of our success or lack of it. Beyond that, of course, it's the secretary. I think that the secretary and her organizational effort at the Department of Health and Human Services is really going to be key. And then finally, in some ways, I would say that the governors are going to be every bit as important as the secretary or the president, because so much of what has to be done at the state level with the leadership of the governors. And here I have some concern. You have a lot of governors who have campaigned in opposition to the law and have even talked about eliminating Medicaid altogether in their states. That's a problem. But at the same time, we have a very important default opportunity here. If the states, for whatever reason, choose not to implement, the secretary has the ability to step in. That's going to be a tough, tough, and very confrontational environment. But nonetheless, at least you have that fallback, as maybe as inadequate as it may be.
Senator, as a longtime veteran of health reform efforts, you, of course, were very familiar with the Harry and Louise ads that helped derail the Clinton administration efforts on health reform. And in your book, you describe really the sea change that took place during the Obama reform efforts. Chip Kahn, who headed the hospital or the Health Insurance Association of America during the Clinton era, was now at the table as the head of the Federation of American Hospitals. And some of America's best known and largest insurers, like the Aetna, were on record as supporting the need for health reform. Why the shift, do you think? 30 million potential new insured customers, or a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really do some fundamental reform that addresses, again, those rising costs, uneven quality, and the access gaps?
Well, I think it's really one of those cases where it's all of the above, Margaret. You've got, clearly you have an opportunity for the stakeholders to benefit from this law in just a number of ways. You mentioned one, of course, insurance companies accessing potentially 30-plus million more customers. Doctors are extremely frustrated with the current system, especially Medicare reimbursement. This provides an opportunity for a paradigm shift in reimbursement. Hospitals the same way, with the real possibilities of medical homes and maybe bundled payments where hospitals have more control. There are a lot of different pluses here, but I think also it's the flip side. All the stakeholders know that our current track is untenable. When it comes to access, cost, and quality, we can't sustain the many, many problems that are multiplying by the year in our current system. So they realize, as we all do, as those many of us do, the importance of changing our circumstances and creating a new marketplace that allows for us to address these problems much more seriously.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with former Senator Tom Daschle, author of the new book, Getting It Done, How Obama and Congress Finally Broke the Stalemate to Make Way for Healthcare Reform. Senator, I asked you a little earlier about who were the people most likely to keep the dream alive, and one of your current projects is serving as co-chair along with the late senator's widow, Victoria Kennedy, on the Health Information Center, a Democratic-led effort to defend and explain the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and what it means to Americans. You laid out that there were really three drivers. It seems like there might be a fourth in terms of voices from the public. What's your strategy for communicating and informing Americans about the bill, the sort of handling the misinformation in an era where the phrases Obamacare and government or overreach are part of the public psyche?
Well, Mark, just one clarification. Vicki Kennedy and I don't have any formal relationship in that effort. We are very informal, along with many other advisors who mm-hmm. are hoping to help the administration and others who share our determination to continue to see the law implemented as was planned. But to your question, first and foremost, I think it's critical that the president and the administration step up its visibility efforts, its messaging, and do what it can from the White House, from the Congress, from the Department of Health and Human Services to make sure people fully appreciate the magnitude of good that can come from this this bill. Secondly, I think it's also important for the stakeholders to be as engaged. I worry a little bit. I'm very appreciative of the stakeholders' cooperation and the kind of effort that they've made so far since implementation, their attitude about the importance of making sure that it is implemented. But I'd love to see the stakeholders step up and become even more vocal and more visible than they've been to date. I think that's critical. Third, I think it's you have a lot of advocacy groups that understand why this is so important. And they, too, need to join the chorus and become more engaged.
Senator Daschle, the Republicans are the new majority in the House, and many have pledged a commitment to repealing the bill, even though repeal would seem to be well-nigh impossible. We are hearing a lot about the Republican strategy to defund parts of the law. Can you clarify for our listeners what has already been funded and is really protected in the reform bill? And conversely, what are the possible provisions in the law that Republicans could block or tamper with through withholding appropriations or even defunding?
Much of the bill is entitlement funding. That is, it's legislated and not appropriated. So those areas that are provided for in the law under Medicaid and under Medicare in particular that are enhancements of the entitlement system are not ones that could be defunded with simply withholding funds because Congress doesn't have that authority. There are also other provisions that are given to the Secretary to implement without further congressional involvement, and she has a great deal of flexibility in providing the funding necessary. So it's those areas that are more directly tied to annual appropriations that could be a challenge. And they could, of course, attempt to legislate a no funds shall be provided for phrase in the appropriations to take away the Secretary's authority to do some of that. But that would take a presidential signature as well. So the bottom line, they don't have nearly the autonomy or the authority that they might think they have with regard to complete defunding. Some of it, yes. But I think a large portion of it will go through regardless of what Congress does.
Senator Daschle, of cost, quality, and access, the most difficult may be reining in cost, which is clearly tied to quality and access. You describe in your book possible approaches, bundle payments, accountable care organizations, beefing up primary care, and putting a new emphasis on prevention. Some would say a lot of this is more hypothetical than real. What's your response to that?
Well, Mark, I've always felt that what we have to do is to come up with a better decision-making capacity. We don't have that today. The ongoing debate about the sustainable growth rate for doctors' reimbursement under Medicare is a good example. And so that's one reason why I've strongly supported the Independent Payment Advisory Board concept and the other mechanisms that are in the bill that allow us a little more streamlined and a little more insulated decision-making capacity than we have today or that we had before this law was passed. So I think it starts with that. Secondly, I think there is a fairly good appreciation that there is so much more that has to be done, in part because Congress didn't have the capacity to get tougher on cost containment because of the politics and complexity involved, and in part because we really aren't sure which is the best approach to use. As you know, there's going to be a number of demonstration, pilot projects, and studies with very significant opportunities for review and ultimate decision-making within the law itself that will allow us a more consequential cost containment strategy as we go forward. In that regard, I'd say we're probably at best on the 10 or 20-yard line. We've got a long way to go, 80 to 90 yards, before we can really achieve the cost containment. But I think we've got the team on the field, and now the question is to move that ball down the field, and I think we can do that.
Senator, you wrote that President Obama had concluded that the only way to spread the cost of covering everyone around, to ending lifetime limits and pre-existing condition denials, to ending the practice of dropping people when they got sick, was to require that everybody had health insurance so there'd be enough healthy people paying premiums to offset those higher costs of less healthy people. But you can't do that without providing subsidies to help the people who can't afford it, which is, of course, what we saw ultimately as part of the bill.
That seems both obvious and rational, and yet the individual mandate to have health insurance is one of the most hotly contested provisions. Why do you think, when people accept mandatory no-fault car insurance so easily, is this such a tough one for Americans to support?
Well, I think this whole debate has been about the role of government and what is the appropriate role of government. It plays itself out in just about every one of the issues. What is the role of government? And this was another illustrative example of the deep division that exists within our country with regard to the answer to that question. In large measure, it's not the individual mandate, but it's the government telling people they have to buy insurance. As you say, Margaret, there's plenty of precedents for that all through society. And ironically, many of those who have argued that there shouldn't be an individual mandate are the same ones who have argued for the need for personal responsibility, taking more responsibility as individuals. Well, I can't think of a better demonstration of personal responsibility than to take care of yourself, first to stay healthy, and secondly, to pay for your illness if you get sick. That's what the individual mandate is about as well. It's partly an effort to make sure insurance concepts can be applied across the board, and including everybody, but it's also partly a personal responsibility. Is healthcare a right? I happen to believe it is a moral right, but along with that right comes a responsibility, and that's what we're talking about here.
Senator Daschle, we'd like to ask all of our guests, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
I'd suggest a book by T.R. Reid called Healing in America, which is an analysis of that very question as it applies to health. Mr. Reid, I think, does an exceptional job of pointing out where other countries have done better than we have. The old myth is that we have the best system in the world. Well, we have some of the best institutions in the world and certainly some of the finest doctors and the best technology, but we aren't anywhere close to being the best system or marketplace in the world, and I think we can learn from other countries on prevention, on wellness, on the whole notion of making sure that we as a community take a greater responsibility for wellness than we do in the United States. Obesity continues to be a huge problem. Other countries are beginning to understand that a little more quickly and put in place implementations of plans and programs that will allow them to address it. Great Britain is a good example. But I think that we have a lot of work to do in that regard. And as your question suggests, we can learn from other countries.
And I think we interviewed T.R. Reid on the show not too many months ago, so we couldn't agree with you more. That was a fascinating book. Today we've been speaking with Tom Daschle, the former senator and Senate Majority Leader from South Dakota. His new book, published by Thomas Dunn Books, is called Getting It Done, How Obama and Congress Finally Broke the Stalemate to Make Way for Healthcare Reform. Senator, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it a good deal.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea comes to us from Afghanistan, where a new midwifery training program is making childbirth safer in a country with the second highest maternal and infant mortality rate in the world. The program was created by JAPIGO, an international health organization affiliated with Johns Hopkins University. This nonprofit has a track record empowering frontline health workers for almost four decades, and its efforts have improved healthcare for women and children in more than 140 countries worldwide. Afghanistan, just one of 50 international efforts currently going on. 6 years ago, JAPIGO developed a plan to provide remote mountain villages in Afghanistan, often very far away from health clinics, with the resources that they needed to stop preventable deaths in childbirth. JAPIGO has worked with Afghanistan's Ministry of Public Health to increase the number of village health clinics and to establish accredited midwifery schools in every province of the country. Now, young women can attend an 18-month midwifery training course in their provincial capital. And although women are not typically allowed to have jobs or travel alone in traditional Afghan society, a new system has been developed where village health councils enable the community leaders to choose which women will receive the training based on their aptitude and interest and their relationship with the community. The women return as midwives to their villages, respected and ready to provide a full spectrum of prenatal delivery and postpartum health services. These new midwives are usually based at the closest health clinic, but many travel high into the mountains every day to visit patients who are unwilling or unable to travel to the clinic. While the presence of a midwife is a new experience for many Afghan mothers, most welcome the reassurance that these health workers provide. In just over 6 years, JAPAIGO's midwifery training program has already begun to transform the reality of motherhood in Afghanistan, where women have an average of 7 children in their lifetimes. The percentage of deliveries attended by skilled birth attendants has increased from 8% in 2003 to 19% in 2006. By training midwives to provide the delivery support and the infant care education that new mothers need, JAPAIGO is strengthening Afghanistan's healthcare system and improving maternal and infant survival rates across the country. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.